Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1136. Hey, I have a production company called Fish Ladder, and we make television shows from time to time. And one of them that we're executive producing is finally just premiered. It is the animated version of the really popular webcomic Poorly Drawn Lines, which is a fantastic comic and has also now become a fantastic animated show. And it has such an incredible cast. P.S. featuring frequent At Midnight and ID10T podcast visitor Ronald Funches is on there as well. So the show is great. I'm so excited about it. It is Thursdays at 10 p.m. On Cake, which is FXX. And it's basically like a short-form animation program. And so it's just it's a really cool thing, and I'm so glad that Fish Ladder was able to be a part of it as an executive producer. Just a fantastic show. So there you go. Please watch that. Oh, and if you miss it on Cake on FXX, then it airs the next day. It gets posted on FX on Hulu. So there's already... got to be an episode up now because it just premiered. So Poorly Drawn Lines, Cake on FXX and FX on Hulu. Please watch it. This is the Corkboard now. Let's do the Corkboard and talk about you, the ID10T community, events at ID10T.com. Like Chris and Tony, who write, we're a couple of friends that are obsessed with all things pop culture and the connection between people, events, movies, books, and more. So we created a podcast where we take two seemingly unconnected things in pop culture and explore what links them. Think 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but across all media. We just posted our third episode, Weird Al Yankovic and Kurt Vonnegut. And we'd love for other pop culture nerds to check it out. Let us know what they think. Find the Pop Culture Connection on all podcast platforms. What a great idea. It kind of reminds me of that old show, Connections, where they take, you know, two really seemingly disparate things in history and find out how they're connected. It's such a great idea to do that for pop culture. So thank you for sharing, Chris and Tony, and to everyone else, events at id10t.com. This episode is David Yaroveski, or Yarvo, as I know him, my friend Yarvo, who is a fantastic director. And he's his third film has just come out. It's called Nightbooks, and it's awesome. It's a real, like, cool, modern gothic fairy tale, but for the family, that is on Netflix right now. Kristen Ritter stars in it. It's just a really, really, really cool movie, and I highly recommend it. Yarvo came on after he did The Hive, and then he came on after he did Brightburn, and now he's come on after Nightbooks, and hopefully will continue to come on. Just a really good dude and a great filmmaker, and it's really great when he comes on because, you know, not only do we get to catch up, but also I get to ask a lot of questions about the process of directing and how it evolves with each movie. So you can watch Nightbooks on Netflix right now. I mean, you could right now, or you could listen to this podcast and then watch it, or you could watch it and then listen to this podcast, or you could do it both at the same time, because we've now figured out how to splinter our attention into multiple different chambers so that we can consume multiple things at the same time. So here you go. This is the ID10T podcast number 1136 with David Yarveski, a.k.a. Yarvo. Roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
You know what I can't stop thinking? Don't tell me you didn't sing. Working on the night books. Come on. I can't. Ever since I heard the title for that movie, I cannot stop singing that in my head. Night books! Yeah, I remember. Yarvo, I don't peg you as a Bob Seger fan.
Yeah, I'm not.
I see you more in the Tool, Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, I hate how well you know me.
Yeah.
I got an alert from Spotify that I was like in a top percentile of people who listen to Tool on Spotify. Like, I listened to it like an incredibly high amount. I don't know, I was like in like a one percentile of Tool fans or something.
Have you put any Tool songs in any of the films?
No. And I don't think I've really made a movie that would make sense to have Tool in, but I would love to. I mean, I would love to do something with that someday. But
where are you back in LA now?
No, I'm in Aspen. I don't know what this is here.
That's some Aspen art. There used to be like this huge comedy festival in Aspen that has been defunct now for like, I don't know, maybe like 15 years or something. But for the longest time, like Aspen had the defining, it was the HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. It was like the defining comedy festival. Uh-huh. And I performed it a couple of times and I was shocked at how many art galleries a tiny mountain town could have. I mean, it's like art gallery.
So many.
Like, it's a lot of art galleries for a ski town.
But I'm out here with James. I'm staying with James. We both, he finished Squad and I finished Nightbooks. And I think we both needed a little downtime.
A little downtime because you just finished this movie and then James is going off to do yet another tentpole film.
Yeah, yet another massive movie. So, you know, take your downtime when you can get it, I guess.
Well, you have to, because it's so easy to just think you never can stop. Because if you lose even a second of momentum, it's all going to fall apart. Oh, my God. Never work again. I took a month off. What's going to, how are we going to, oh, it's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine.
I don't have that disease. I don't have that thing that you're describing where I feel like, and maybe that's because, you know, I mean, I had downtime. I mean, I had some time off between Brightburn and this movie, and I had downtime between The Hive and Brightburn, and I, you know what I mean? Like, so I guess I've just naturally, my flow has been that. You know,
I will occasionally sort of entertain the idea of like, oh, it'd be really fun to direct a movie. I have some ideas. I've talked to Blumhouse about doing stuff. And then I feel like right when Brightburn came out and you and I were talking and then I was reminded like, oh yeah, it's not just the whatever, however many weeks you're actually directing the thing. I mean, you sit with this thing for like 2-3 years. And that scared me a lot away where I was like, oh, I don't know if I can just focus on this one thing for a couple of years. That would really freak me out. So
Yeah, it's an endeavor. And I know that every moment of the day that I can be like I do things. I do things and I regiment my time and my schedule, my eating schedule, my sleep schedule and all that stuff so that I can be just maximum available for the maximum amount of hours and to be as productive as possible for those out. You know what I mean?
Of course.
So it's, yeah, it is from the moment you book the job, like the race is on. And you don't know when you're first starting out, you don't realize, but yeah, I mean, every day that goes by is another day that you could have prepped a scene. You could have had an idea. You could have pushed something. You could have pulled these images to share an idea that you had with this. You know, it's like, it's just, you just, you know, it's an all encompassing job. In fact, the thing about the job is interesting because you're making decisions all day and you have no idea how weird that is on your brain until you get home and someone's like, hey, what do you want to have for dinner tonight? Or like, what do you want to do for dinner? And you're like,
put food in mouth. Me, yeah. No.
I can't make another decision. I'm out of the capacity to decide things. Just, yeah. Just
it's when you're sitting with others, like, what should we have for dinner? And you're like, what's in the budget? Well, no, anything. It's not, it has nothing to do with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, but yeah.
I find the other thing that seems interesting to me or what I imagine is challenging as a director is, you know, as a film viewer, you know, we see like a finished product, but you have to see that in your head the entire time. You're seeing a set and people and how things might look in a room and maybe they'll look good on camera, but every day you have to show up. I feel like the analogy that I think of is it's like if every day someone said, here's some watercolors, every day I want you to paint a picture and it's got to tell a story, you know, over a period of 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 9 weeks. But you have to just intuitively use roughly the same color palette so that it'll all match. You know, it's like you have to every day you somehow have to tone match as you get new ideas, as things come up, as you have to be flexible and things that you shoot in 9 weeks. It's like, who fucking remembers what they did 9 weeks ago? But somehow something you shot 9 weeks ago has to match as though if you were watching it, that it just happened like seconds ago. And that is very mind bendy to me.
Yeah. You have a team of people who are helping you and you still mess up. You know what I mean? I have a woman, you know, on Nightbooks who sat next to me the entire movie and she's the person I talked to most, you know, of course we were filming during COVID. So we were both in like, you know, plexiglass phone booths and knocking on the booth and communicating by gestures and yelling and stuff. But she was the person I talked to most on the movie. And it's like, yeah, every day it's like, where does the scene come from? Where's it going? What were they just wearing? What were they, how did they enter? Were they moving right to left? Were they moving left to right? But yeah, it's a lot to keep in your head. And you just, you know, I think people don't realize, I think, what a craft it is. And like, you learn, like I'm still learning. I love coming on your show. Like I really love coming on your show. And after every movie I've made, I've been on your show.
Yeah.
And 100% of the movies I've made, I've then immediately come to your show. And one day I intend to like watch all of these back to back. Cause for some reason on your show, I'm fortunate enough to talk about my favorite thing, which is, you know, how to make a movie or you know, what that process is like. And at the same time, every time I make a movie, I learn so much. So I'm looking forward to going back and listening to all of them and hearing how wrong I was or how different or what I've learned and how I would roll my eyes at how, you know, the things that I would say, the advice I would give on, you know, the Hive versus Brightburn versus now. I don't know. It's just,
well, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why it's so fun, you know, to have you on too, because I feel like you're a wealth of information each time. And because I feel like, you know, there's been this journey of you and the podcast and the films, I really am also kind of mining for information for my own curiosity and purposes, because I really do think directing is probably the hardest job, because it's really like 100 jobs. And even though I do forget sometimes, like, well, yeah, but you also have to be a skilled delegator, and you have to, you know how to let people like shine in the expert areas that you are not expert in. I don't mean you personally, but I just mean you as a, you know, in the general sense. And, but still, you still somehow have to keep the broad vision of it intact and have it planned, but be flexible and learn how to improvise, but also keep everything tonally. So if someone walks out of the room and they walk into another room, and then it's weeks later, that you're able to tell the actor, like, this is exactly what you were tonally doing. Or even if you did a bunch of takes, well, these are the different tone. So it's just like a constant patchwork that somehow you have to keep all in your head and sew together and make it make sense, which I believe is why Lydia and I are so forgiving when we watch movies, and most of what we watch are horror and low budget horror and stuff. And it's like, it's fucking hard to make a movie. So it's so easy, yes, to go, oh, fucking piece of shit, why didn't they fucking, you know, it's like,
yeah,
you don't even know
lazy.
If they lost
He's
the whole
lazy.
Day of film. You don't know. Yeah. It's like, it's so hard just to make a movie. So I really am fascinated by the process of it.
Also, everyone assumes that every frame of the movie is exactly as the director intended. And there's no real benefit for any director to come out and be like, well, yeah, I lost this battle, or I didn't win, you know what I mean? Or like, didn't, you know, we ran out of time on this day, or we this or this. And like, the truth is that every director you talk to will watch a movie front to back, and they'll be proud of aspects of the movie. This is speaking generally about a movie. And then parts of the movie, they're like, oh, we didn't get there with that scene. Ooh, I wish I had another day to cut that or tweak that. I wish, you know, I had that line that I wanted to give them, but I didn't give them. And then now I regret it. You know, you like, you know, it's a, to me, I watch a movie and it always feels like a revisiting a battlefield, you know. And it's not like I it's not to say that that my sets are like arguy or fighty. It's not at all that, but I just mean a battlefield in the sense that, like, you know, you go to war with this idea, you want to create this thing, and you have this vision in your head for what the movie is, and then you have what the movie actually is when you're done making it, and they're different things. They just will always be different things, no matter how much money you have, no matter how much control you have, because the journey of making it shapes it, and the collaborators you have shape it. And I look at the movie, I watch the movie as a series of like, oh, that scene is even better than I imagined it would be. Oh, that scene did not become as strong as I thought it would be. And it's frustrating, you know what I mean? And it's sort of like that's the journey, you know? And I think, you know, the people I envy the most oftentimes, you know, cause I do think of myself like as an artist, like, just growing up, I felt like an art kid, you know, and I still kind of feel like an art kid. And I get these images in my head or these stories I want to tell. And then I look at like people who can draw, or like, you know, a songwriter who can sit down and write a song by his or herself, like in, you know, they can open a session on their computer and make something. And I'm so jealous because, like, you know, I have an idea, like, it would be cool if we did like an evil superhero Superman horror movie, right? And from the moment I have that idea, you know, we have to convince people to give us money. We have to convince, you know what I mean? I have to get millions of dollars to make this idea become real. And then I have to convince actors that they should come be in the movie. And then I have to tell every, you know, and by the time I'm actually seeing the the idea realized. It's, you know, two, three year journey. I hear filmmakers who've had 10-year journeys, 20-year journeys to accomplish that thought that they had and to see it realized. And the, you know, you look at that credit list and it's like, those are all people I had to work with to achieve this thing. And then I see an artist sit down and like paint something by themselves in their studio. I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a painter, it really doesn't rely on a committee of people to give you permission and then a bunch of people to all agree on the idea as you're going along. But that's why I think directing is really sort of the perfect metaphor for life, which I believe is be as prepared as you can be, but also be flexible to be in the moment and just kind of go with the flow. I was listening to, as I am wont to do, the 80s station on Sirius XM, and they were introing the Survivor song, Eye of the Tiger, which was a big Rocky III song, you know? Mm-hmm. And they were saying that Sylvester Stallone actually wanted Another One Bites the Dust by Queen, but Queen wouldn't give them permission for it. And so it's like, oh, but Eye of the Tiger became this iconic song that was not only a massive hit in the 80s, but also very, very synonymous with Rocky and that, you know. And would Another One Bites the Dust have been awesome? Of course it would have been. It's fucking Queen. It would have been amazing. However, because that, and I'm sure they were upset about it in the moment. They're like, well, I guess we have to go in another direction, you know. I never made the connection with like, oh, the Survivor song is kind of Queen-esque. I think his name is Jimmy Jameson or something, the lead singer, the very high register. It's that kind of bam, you know, the guitar. So, but that kind of whatever happy accident, that other direction they had to go in because they were open to it, ended up becoming like a defining quality of their thing. And they wouldn't have known that otherwise.
Yeah. And you know that when they couldn't get Queen, that Stallone went to bed really sad one night.
Yeah, of course he did. Because that was probably in his head the whole time, like, this is going to be awesome. We're going to have the Queen song. It's like, you're not going to have the Queen song. Oh, man, I put so much emotional energy. I built so much around that. But then they problem solve and they come up with a better solution.
They release it and people are like, this song is genius. And he's like, Yeah, this is what I wanted.
I thought you wanted the Queen. Oh, I don't think so.
I don't remember that.
No, I don't remember that either. I hope no one tells that story on a satellite radio station someday. but it is, you know, it is that sort of rigidity of our ideas that I think you're talking about too, where you can get so planted in an idea and you really think. And but then how many times, you know, when you go, oh, this one scene I thought should have been this and it wasn't. It's very often, unfortunately, the things you don't expect, which I think is good because it reminds you, like, you never know. So just kind of do what you can do and allow yourself to be surprised in either direction and just kind of try to go with it.
The movie I watch when I watch my movie is not the movie you watch when you watch my movie. And it's not the movie that anyone watches. It's a completely different thing. I mean, you could get really philosophical about it and think about how every single person has their own unique experience and they see their own movie when they watch the movie. But it is specifically true that the movie that I watch is not the movie that you watch. When I watch it, I dream of moments where I can sit with an audience and for like 10 minutes get pulled in and just be an observer watching it. Just watch it through the eyes of the crowd and just enjoy it as a movie. But whenever I see anything I've done, it's you're watching it, you're analyzing it. Does it still work? You're remembering the process of making it. You see all the seams, you know that there used to be a line in between this line and this line. And you wonder, was that the right choice to remove that line? But yeah, I didn't need that piece of information in this scene, you know? And so there's so much. And also, you know, I've yet to make a movie that I haven't had an incredibly intense emotional connection to. I had, you know, this movie Night Books that I just made, I made it. It is not a hard R movie like previous movies I made. It is a family friendly movie. But it is weirdly even more personal than any movie I've ever made before. It is.
I was going to ask you about that without giving too much away. It's sort of like these ideas. I mean, I think it's okay to talk about this. We won't spoil anything, but it's like that sense that I think a lot of artists feel, writers, you know, whatever, like, you got to write for your life. Like, you're writing to save your life. And then there's always a critic who's like, every time the kid's stuff would get criticized, I'd be like, oh, that's the internet. Or that's a, you know, like, that's a shitty teacher who told someone, like, that's dumb. How do you not know this or this or this? It's like, it's the internal monologue that I think almost every creative person has with themselves. And so I do see it as this really kind of great, you know, gothic classic horror fairy tale, but at the core of it, it really, to me, was about the artistic struggle.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very much about exactly. I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, I've talked to so few people who've seen the movie, you know, and yeah, I mean, it is, you know, I read the script and was like, okay, that's weird. This is describing me as a kid. And being, you know, it was like, you know, I think in the original script, by the way, I think in the original script, I think it said he wears a Freddy shirt. And I was like, I wore a Freddy shirt to school every day. And then when we were looking into it, it was like a legal nightmare to get a Freddy shirt. So I wasn't married to a Freddy shirt because I wore Jason shirts and Michael Myers, you know, I just wore anything horror. But so he's wearing a Michael Myers shirt, right? When you first meet him, and his room is full of, you know, horror memorabilia and Fangoria magazines and all this stuff.
Posters. I think I maybe spied a People Under the Stairs poster for like a half a second.
Oh yeah. There's a People Under the Stairs.
Wes Craven shout out.
There's a Dead Alive poster, which I was very excited to get on that wall. No, there's a bunch of really cool posters on the wall. But like, you know, that literally was me. I have a picture of my room growing up. And I, as I started going through the movie and realizing really what it's about, I started to go, I know this story uniquely. I was teased. I was bullied, man. I was bullied for just looking different, looking weird. People were scared of me. You know, they thought I might, you know, they didn't know what to think of me. You know, they thought I was weird and scary. And I don't know, they thought I'd like cast spells on them or something. It's a weird time for kids, you know, there's just a lot of pressure, I think, nowadays, you know, and I worry about creatives and the pressure on creatives, like being a creative kid, being a weird kid. You know, I have friends who were weird like me, who were creative like me, and they did not pursue the creative path. And there's a little piece in my heart that is sad for them, because, you know, it's, I don't know. Anyways, the point, all of this is to say that I really wanted to make a love letter to this next generation from a kid who went through it all, who got bullied in every way you can get bullied. And I wanted to say, you know, it's, you know, keep being weird and keep doing your thing, because it's magic, you know? And that's what the movie is.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. with SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5. This foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Yeah, and you kind of, and you make the point in the movie too that like ordinary is boring, you know, like if you're being like everybody else, and which is so funny because I feel like when we're young, we're so compelled to try to fit in. We're so compelled to try to fit in, but it is those sort of offbeat qualities. And me, it was my obsession with, you know, sci-fi and horror, but mainly stand-up comedy. And other kids weren't obsessed with stand-up comedy. They weren't quoting Steve Martin and, you know, every comedy special that they saw. And so it was weird, you know, it was weird. And, but those things were really the seeds of like creative inspiration that would take root and fruit later on in my life. But how could I know that as a kid? I just felt like, oh, I don't understand why I don't like sports, or I don't know how to talk to other kids about the dumb things that they talk about. I don't, what's wrong with me? And I'm just glad that I kind of like hung in there, you know, for whatever reason, and was able to pursue the things that I love, because how many people don't? But I do think that, you know, the internet is a blessing and a curse, and a blessing in the sense that all the weirdos can, you know, like all the creative people can find each other and connect and be a support group for each other. But also it has certainly widened the bullying arena of people, you know, like just telling you that your stuff is dumb, or, you know, so if you can somehow separate. I mean, I don't envy having to grow up at this time. I mean, it's hard enough when you just feel like, you know, your little heart is on the line just for the immediate community you live in, let alone like now the whole fucking world.
Yeah, man. Like you're exactly right. Like the Fangoria magazines and the horror stuff just color on a universal experience. Like you and me are connected in so many ways in our experience. You know, we had such a similar, just in the way you talk about it there, is like we had such a similar experience. And I know so many people like us who had that experience. You know, I growing up, I had a lot of musician friends, and they, you know, they couldn't talk about football and stuff because they wanted to talk about, you know, Nirvana. And they wanted to talk about Nine Inch Nails and Tool and stuff, and break down that music, and their posters were covered up. And but it's all the same journey. It's like, why are we compelled to? We found something in the world that we're just obsessed with, and for some, there's something in it that we love, and we wanted to understand it. Initially, we just wanted to understand it. Why did Freddy scare me? Why did this joke make me laugh? Why did this, you know what I mean? And then as you get older, you're like, I think I can do this to someone else. I think I can maybe make someone laugh. I think I can scare the shit out of someone, you know, but tell them a story that they can connect to in some way. And I want everyone who right now is obsessed with something to just follow that, to just like get good at it, to know it, to like blow the next generation's mind with some piece of art that, like, you know, or some story, some joke that like makes everyone laugh for a year. Like, please, please do that. And don't give it up.
Well, this
don't lose it.
Yeah, this is something I feel like I said on a recent podcast, but I want to repeat it as much as I repeat myself. But I want to repeat it because I've had a really interesting journey with it, which is, you know, just I've been writing lately, just literally for me, like to not, you know, like writing stuff, writing, you know, stand up, writing just songs, you know, and because I'm learning these instruments, and I kind of had this thought of like, I'm just going to do this for myself. Like, because I feel like so much of what we do is for the approval, like relies on the approval of other people, and not just the creative endeavors and the commercially creative endeavors, you know, so that we can make our hobbies like our careers, but also just like our like online lives, like everything is submitted for approval. And so it becomes very easy to fall into the space where we can get so torn down by what other people that we don't even know, or maybe don't even like, if someone was shitty to you and you're like, and you really broke it down, you're like, oh, I don't even really like this person. Why do I care about what they think about it? You know, this is famous Stoic line of like, why do you put more stock in other people's opinions that you wouldn't normally care about over your own about yourself? And so I've been like, you know, I'm really enjoying this thing where I'm just making stuff for myself, and I may never perform it or release it or whatever. And what's been really gratifying about that is that it just sort of takes the external approval thing out of it. And maybe someday I will perform it and that will be fine. But for now, I'm not really thinking about that. And it has freed me up in so many ways that it's been a joyous experience. So I share that again, just kind of reminding people like, yeah, if you want to make, if your goal is money or your goal is like, you know, maybe you do have to start trying to submit everything for approval, but just creatively, to be creatively fulfilled, maybe just try doing it just for yourself. And you don't have to tell anyone about it yet. Just see how it makes you feel. Then later on, you can decide if you want to release it after you've already kind of cemented your own security with it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, it makes 100% sense to me. I mean, I'm really fortunate. I've never made a choice based on money. Like every movie that I've made, I really wanted to make. And I know that there's filmmakers out there who make a movie. They have to, or they feel like this would be a great career move, or they do these things. And I am not criticizing them at all, but I'm just feel fortunate. And man, it comes from a place, but I have done commercials in the past that are, you know, you take commercial, that's a job, you know, you do the job. I've done music videos in the past. At times I have huge passion for the job, but sometimes it was a job. And man, what a difference it feels like to, it just reminds you why I'm doing this in the first place. You know, like if I wanted to make money, like there were better ways. There were so many better ways. The amount of time and effort and heart and tears and just, man, that I put into this career, I could have made money doing other things. Like I could spend half the time and probably made way more money than I make. But that's not what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I knew that the only thing that would make me happy was telling stories. And there's another piece of it, which is that I have a technical fascination. Like I really like pushing the boundaries of like the technical aspects of filmmaking and how we can use new tech to explore different ideas or do things in a different way, which gives you an upper hand on storytelling. I love the marriage of technology and filmmaking. It's just, man, I bleed that. I can't imagine a day in my life not doing that stuff. You know?
Well, and you also do a really great blend of practical effects and you sort of cake decorate it with CG. I mean, I'm sure that some of the cat had to be CG because you just can't get a cat to facially react the way that you need, you know, one of those cats to facially react. But in general, like there's a character that turns up at the end of the movie that's like, holy shit, what a rad, like such cool, there are such cool like makeup effects. And there's really great creature work in this movie too. And a dark version of a popular archetype of a creature without giving it away, that's like, holy shit, I never thought, like, there's just some really great reimaginings of things in here that I think people are really gonna respond to, but it's obvious that you love the creature work so much, even down to like the eyes in certain parts and the cool, like there's really cool stuff with eyes and characters. It's like, I just imagine you like really geeking out. I'm like, how fucking weird and cool can we make these eyes? Like almost like Willy Wonka style. Like how can we do this?
Yes, that is true. I you know, so K and B did our like our practical makeup effects, and they did an incredible job. And then Mr. X did our visual effects, and they also did an incredible job. And I like, you know, coming into this movie, one of my personal goals was to create. I wanted to like create the experience I had, like, you know, watching, you know, Amblin movies that would be scary and mysterious and but emotional, and it would be a whole journey. It wasn't just like okay, I went in and I laughed and then I got out. It was like it took me on a whole journey. And one of the when I really analyzed like what made those movies, you know, there's technical things, you know, there's the way, the style of cinematography, there's the way they were shot. There's certain technical things that gave it that look. But one of the things that I really got obsessed with was like making it doing everything we can to make it feel real. And like to really imagine, like, this is an incredibly fantastical concept. There's wild things, and it gets wilder the deeper into the movie you go. But doing everything you can to give it a sense of reality. What if there was a magical apartment? What if there was a witch? What if there was, you know, this apartment that if you opened a door, it could go into a giant library? You know, and doing everything you can to make it feel real. And I think, you know, at times, you know, filmmaking at its, you know, I don't know, the stuff that doesn't really work for me is the stuff that looks pretty. It looks great in a style frame. It looks great in the trailer, but it just feels like a cartoon. It feels like I'm watching stuff just happen that looks cool, but it just doesn't feel real. And this is a long way of saying, going back to what you were saying, that I also found that the most realistic looking things are when we use practical effects and then augment them with CG.
Mm-hmm.
And the deeper into the CG well you go, you realize, you know, every time someone complains about CG or like, oh, crappy CG, or they just threw money at it and made CG happen, it's because if you look at that shot under a microscope, there's just 100 things that are happening that aren't real. You know, the skin is like shiny and no one's skin is shiny. You know, there's like, you know, the light goes into your skin and bounces around, and there's subsurface light scattering that occurs that you don't even think about when you look at it, but suddenly that's a thing. And you know what your eyes do, the rate at which your eyes move. Sometimes you look at, you know, CG characters and their eyes are moving too slow or too deliberate. And it's like, so the question is, how real can you make it, you know, and how much can you make the audience feel like they're really on this journey? Because you're taking people on a dream. You're like, yeah, this is this dream state. And you're that person is sort of seeing these shots and assembling a story in their mind. And like, so much of it is like, you want it to feel real. You want to be taken to these places and you want to feel the threat and you want to fall in love with the characters and you want to do those things. And so, I don't know. I think there's that focusing on that was a mantra of mine. And also just trying to find ways to use both and just make the most convincing encounters with, you know, Lenore, the most convincing encounter with that shredder creature, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it kind of reminds me a bit of how Chris Columbus was on the podcast, like, I don't know, 9 months ago or something, and he was talking about
cool.
He was awesome. Talking about how his original idea for Gremlins was just a straight up horror movie. And very coincidentally, like it was on someone's desk and Spielberg picked it up and took it home to read it and fell in love with it. But then said to him, like, it's a really cool idea. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. It's a really cool idea, but there's no heart in it. Like you need to have like an emotional center. It needs to have a heart. And so they added this whole element, which he's like, it was a genius. He was absolutely right. You know, and so that's where you get this, you know, this gizmo, you know, like, you know, and I sort of think about it as like, okay, well, if you're making a movie, like, where's your gizmo, you know, like, what's the heart of it? And so for this, it's this very real emotion of like this fear that we fear as creative people, or this idea of being bullied, or like the creative things that we're into, other people don't get them. So they're like, it's fucking stupid. You're dumb. This is dumb. You're dumb. You know, and just because, you know, I guess evolutionarily we're sort of programmed to need approval so that, well, I guess be a society and function. I don't know, but it is overactive in the sense that like, we can't be immobilized by that fear. So there really is like a real emotional center to this. And it just happens to be decorated with this gothic fairy tale skin, you know, and everyone in the movie is great. The kids are great. And Kristen Ritter is awesome in it. She really is just she just plays this really great witch who's all over the place and
unbelievably mean, right? She's unbelievably mean to them at times.
Unbelievably mean. But again, you know, you find out why. And it's sort of like, and it's sort of like why, you know, going back to the original X-Men movie was at a time where like that was very revolutionary, I think, in terms of like superhero films, because we were very used to looking at heroes and villains, and we didn't really ever understand the villain. And all of a sudden we see Eric Lyncher and Magneto, and we see this villain who's like, oh, well, in the first 5 minutes of the movie, you completely sympathize with this horrible thing he's been through and why he never wants any group to ever go through what he and his family went through again. And so all of a sudden it adds this dimension. So he's just not this big bad villain who's just doing evil things. It's like, yes, he's expressing things in a very bad way, but you see like the beginnings of how could that have happened. And so you reveal some things, like it's so hard to, without giving anything away. Anyway, it's not just, you know, evil villain, you know, yes, she's very mean.
Yes.
But when you start peeling back some of the layers, some of it's like, oh, here's how she became that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny, right? Like, I think people don't really think about movies like this, but we instinctively do. Like, we've all seen a movie and been like, it was fine. That movie was fine. Why should I care? Why did, you know, like, it's the equivalent of like when you're at a party and a friend is telling you a story and you're like, what was the point of that story? Like, you know, you get to the end of the story and you're like, what? We were talking about, like, I don't know, ashtrays. What the hell did that have to do with ashtrays, dude? And it's like,
I feel like I do that all the time, by the way. I'm the person that goes on the weird tangent and everyone's like, why are we talking about, you know, balloons now? We were talking about ashtrays. I don't know. I just started talking.
I just thought this thing. I've come to think of filmmaking as not all too different from me sitting at a party across from you and telling you, what happened the other day? This, and starting to tell the story. And the more believable it is, you know, the more you can get pulled into it, the more surprises, the more twists and turns in it, the more you might get pulled into the story. And at the end of the story, that it better have some point, because I'm sitting here listening to you for who knows how long, 20 minutes, 15 yeah. minutes, it could have been 2 hours, who knows? And you get to the end, you better be like, oh, I see why you were telling me the story. It all makes sense now. You know, that really, like, those are like the basic fundamentals of movie making that often get overlooked for, it looks great, it sounds great, there's cool stuff, oh, that one action sequence kicked ass, But it's like, why'd you tell me the story in the first place? And I think that's where you're getting at with what Spielberg was tapping into with Gremlins. You know, like, this is really cool. This has the mechanics of everything, but why should I care? Why will it be more than just, you know, I jumped a couple times?
Yeah. And like, the thing about the party is that, yes, people are paying you in their time and attention, but then you're making a movie and then they're also literally paying you with money. I mean, I guess it'd be like if you went to the grocery store and you spent 90 minutes in a grocery store and you paid the clerk $100 and you left without any groceries. It's like, what did I just spend? Like, shouldn't I have something to take home? I spent a lot of time and money. Well, sorry, fuck you, too bad, you know?
Yes, 100%. And everyone has a bunch of stories in their life that they tell over and over and over again, right? They have like their collection of stories that things have happened to them or whatever. And those stories they've been a filmmaker with, they've shopped, they've told so many times that they realized, oh, this part gets a little long. They've cut it down. They realize that if they start here, it's more surprising when you get to the end, which is like, man, it's like screenwriting 101. Like if you introduce it here and then it gets to here, oh my God, there's like great change that's occurred. And just like, you know, those are all the muscles, you know, and those are all the things that you, I don't know. There's no point to work. I'm just going to crash this story into a wall.
To demonstrate what are my fucking groceries?
Like. Yeah, exactly.
No, but you're right. I mean, it's like, we are a storytelling species, you know, like this is how we understand things. This is how we convey things. Stories are how we survive, you know, and how we pass on information. So how do we, when it's quite literally your profession, how do you do that in a succinct way that conveys all of these things, but without over conveying? It's simple enough, you know,
yes,
but also addresses like complex. And I don't know. I mean, I do think there are some innate parts to it, but then it's also just like practice. And going back to the thing about it can take you 2 or 3 years to make a movie, you know, I could go do stand up two nights, you know, I'm sorry, 7 nights a week, you know, 2 or 3 shows. And all of a sudden I'm getting a ton of practice. You really get to kind of work on one thing at a time and then look back and go, okay, so now what did I learn after that last 2 or 3 years?
Yeah. That's 100% right. Like you are someone, your craft is, and you are someone who I envy, who can just, like you can walk into like you guys, especially, man, cause you guys can riff. You guys can just be handed a mic, go on stage and do your art, you know, and you can I'll do a 15 minute set. And then you do a 15 minute set. Are you kidding? What I wouldn't give to, you know, but like, right. Like, yes, in some ways I look at going to parties and sitting around and like smoking a cigar and having a chat and telling stories about your life with someone as the kind of equivalent of getting to do my art without really having 200 people that I also have to
and navigate it in three-dimensional space as opposed to just like saying words.
Yes. Right. Because I could just be like, okay, so something you need to know about this is blah, blah, blah. And then I can start the story. Right. But in a movie, I'm like, oh, I have to find a way to get the audience's information. It isn't so stupid and obvious. And it isn't just been done, but you know, like it's just, it's such an interesting experience to make movies, and the audience is just getting smarter and better, and they demand more of us. And they're, you know, I mean, you think about it, right? And I bet you feel about this way with comedy, right? Like people just keep coming in and raising the bar, you know? And it's like, damn, did you see how funny this was? Did you see how funny this was? Now that's the new bar. Did you see how good this movie was?
That's creatively inspiring because it makes me go, okay, so the bar is up here. So what can I do? You know, can I improve on that? Can I build on that? Can I find a way into that, around that? You know, it's like we all really do sort of work off each other, but you're right, because just the amount of time that this form of entertainment, you know, going on 100 years now of filmmaking, you know, like this kind of filmmaking,
and sort of like modern stand-up in the last several decades, there's been a lot of it. And so how does it get reinvented? And, you know, there was a time 100 years ago where people could just have their fucking minds blown, just like watching a film of a train go into a tunnel and be like, Jesus Christ, you know, maybe they've never even seen a train in person.
Yeah,
you know? And now we're, you know, like we've seen so much, we can be very spoiled as consumers because, you know, like you can watch a movie that has the most, I mean, like the effects that if you saw like 20 years ago, you'd be like, what the fuck? And now we're just
yes.
like, that's garbage. Ah, that's dumb. It's all so disposable.
Look how CG that is. Yeah, it's so disposable.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like, it's like, wait a minute. Any movie is a fucking achievement, you know, like any movie, no matter how bad it is, any movie is an achievement.
It's an achievement. It really is. And it's like, it's funny because there's all these like common things that people say or think that are so like, it's so sad to me for the artists. You know, I feel so defensive of like artists just in general. And like, you know, one of the things, the sin that everyone commits is like, is they're like, oh, like they threw a bunch of money, like did CG and that was their answer to it. And what that actually looks like is they went and they hired some of the most talented 3D artists in the world to work tirelessly for a year to like try their best to like create these three, they fixated, you know, they had this artist sitting analyzing this image for, you know, and that, you know, went from an animator to modelers, that people were building digital assets to doing fine tweaking, to being colored, to having an incredible composer score it. And man, it, you know, it might not have worked. It might not have been great. But I, you know, anytime people are just like, oh, they threw money at it and just like CG. And I'm like, that's not at all.
Well,
not at
all. You know, what you're describing is a very, is a psychological phenomenon known as the Dunning-Kruger effect, which basically says that people don't know what they don't know. And so they make a lot of easy connections, right? So like, it's the difference between, and that's not to say people can't have their opinions about stuff, but it just means like, if you're on a plane, if you're on a flight and the flight's bumpy or the landing's bad or whatever, you can say, I did not enjoy this flight. I did not enjoy that landing. What you cannot say is this pilot sucks, because you don't know anything about flying to know what challenges they faced, you know, but it's very easy for us who don't know anything about flying to go, this guy sucked. That landing was terrible. Well, but you don't know. You don't know maybe, that he sucks. You know, you just
maybe fucking surface to air missiles were being fired at your plane the whole time.
You know that you didn't like the experience, which you're entitled to, but you can't say like, oh, all they did, you know, we take it so personally now. And it's almost like when we see a movie we don't like, it's so easy to think the director is just laughing, going, ah, I did that. I made this shitty CG just to piss you off, you fucking assholes. It's like, no, you, like they may have done their best. They may have run out of time. Like maybe someone might have died and they lost. Like you don't know what horrible things they went through. And maybe they were like, yeah, fuck you, I don't care. Maybe they did throw it away. But we do often, I feel like people do often paint like the worst shades of intention. It's like, no, they didn't set out to ruin your day. They tried and it just didn't. It's very hard to manifest these things, but they weren't intentionally trying to bum you out. And believe me, unless they're a sociopath, they probably hate themselves right now because they know that it didn't turn out the way they wanted. And they're beating themselves. If you want to be gratified, just know that they're beating themselves up worse than you could.
Way worse than you could. Yes, they are. They are. Yeah, it's like, yeah, yeah. There's that perception, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, the director probably just like phoned it in and didn't care. It's like,
cut to the director on the floor of his hotel room, just sobbing, like talking to his significant other. I'm trying and everything is conspiring against me. I don't know what to do. You know, just having a total mental break to be like, that piece of shit just phoned it in. Oh my God, this guy almost had to be hospitalized.
Yeah. 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 That is, but you know, but you know, there's a piece of it, like the way I come to peace with it is I realize that one of the things about movies is like when what like it's almost like It's almost like, you know, eating a steak. I don't want to know how they cut the steak. I don't want to see all the gory, messy details behind in the butcher shop. I don't want to meet the cow. I don't want to know all those things, because then I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to eat the steak. So it's like there's a certain magic to being like, I don't know, maybe that guy was late. Like, maybe it's okay that the audience sort of thinks that of us, but I feel compelled. I just feel defensive of artists who are, you know, these guys, you know, especially CG artists, man. No one gets crapped on harder than CG artists in this town. You know, on Twitter, there's like, oh, this shot looked terrible. And, you know, there's a CG artist who's, you know, they're not, it's not like a big movie producer. It's, you know, it's someone who has a job, who went into their studio and worked, you know, they went into the shop and they worked really hard on it. They're like, that's my shot.
And they did the best they could with what they had, you know?
Yeah. And they're probably really, really, really good. And oftentimes what you find is if you talk to that artist, they tell you, yeah, I told them this wasn't going to work. I knew this wasn't going to work.
Oh my God. You're so right.
They all the time. They're like, yeah, like I told them, but you know, but it's what it needed to be, or that message didn't get to the higher up or what, you know, like it's like
the lines of communication can be wicked on a movie where there's a bunch of people running around. It's like, well, how come this actor didn't get their call sheet? Well, this person didn't tell this person this, but it's like so many things can go wrong. But you're right about the artist. Maybe they submitted something else and it was, you know, like it would have looked cooler. But I always think about how the same person has been cutting my hair for like 25 years. And he's amazing and I love him and he does makeup for all the shows that I work on and hair, and he's the best. He actually is the one that introduced me and Lydia. He set us up on our
really?
Yeah, he set us up on our date, Sean. I love him. He's the best. He's like family to me. And I find that the only times that I ever go, some of my hair is when I go, hey, you know what? Would you just, he'll finish and I'll go, you know, what if you just cut this one? It's when I try to micromanage because I don't know what I'm fucking talking about. And he did it great. And for whatever reason, in a split second, I was like, oh, I want it this other way, because in my head, I don't know enough to know what I don't know. And I don't know how to manifest things, but he's very sweet. So I'll go, okay. And so he'll do it. And I'll go, oh man, it was better before the way you did it. You know what I should do? And I constantly say, like, I think I'll just trust you to do what you are an expert at doing. Yeah. And how often we just need to, and it's not to say that we can't ask for things or try to craft an image together collaboratively, but oftentimes, like, you know, it is like, let's just trust the creative people that we hire, the experts, to do what they do, because that's what we want when we are hired. Yeah. We don't want like a studio person going, oh yeah, this is good, but can you make those walls orange? Why? I don't know. I just like the color orange. Well, but that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, please let me do it the way that I wanted to do it. I promise you hired me for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. It's that. And it's also bad. It's like, and this is something that, you know, there's no perfecting but there's only getting better at, and it's how you give notes to people. And that's not just directing. That's like, right. If you were like, hey, you know what? Make the front shorter. He'd be like, in his head, he'd be like, why the fuck am I making the front shorter? But what's really happened in your mind is like, I saw this photo where my hair was, you know, where the sides were longer and it looked better, or whatever it is, you know, and that might not be the case, but you know, or like, I liked how when it was short, it went this way or something. And so you're not really, you're sort of trying to treat the cause, and in effect, you could actually make your hair look really stupid. Whereas if you're like, make my hair look cleaner, or make my look, make this look tight. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like you wouldn't, you know, if someone was, you know, like if an artist was painting something, or even if it was like, oh, you know, I'm having some work done on my car. And then you went in and you tried to tell the mechanic, like, oh, could you just do, and you didn't know what you were talking about. You're probably going to fuck something up, because you don't know.
again, you don't know what you don't know. So there are probably 10 reasons why the thing that you think would work doesn't work because you don't know how it works. And so, you know, now I kind of just let him do whatever to my hair he wants. It's like, you know, I'll go, oh, maybe, you know, I wouldn't mind having a little longer. So then he does what it does. And I'm like, oh, it looks fucking great.
Yeah.
I trust you. You know what you're doing. I don't know. So just I appreciate it.
Yeah. 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 100%. Yeah. No, there's, you know, that, by the way, that's in everything. That's not filmmaking. That's just it's a way that people manage other people that like often just leads to disaster, right? Because you hire someone to do something that you're not good at. Like I couldn't animate a shot, right? But I can get a shot and I can be like, oh, I wish he lifted his leg a little bit. But, you know, like when I get mad, I do this, you know? So then the note comes through to him and it's like, lift his leg a little more. And he's like, what does that even mean? Lift his leg. And he's like lifting his leg. And what I meant was when I get mad, I'm like, I'm mad, you know, like I like that there's a, that, you know, so what the real note is like, make him move his body in a way that is expressing, you know, frustration, you know, like that thing you do when you're frustrated, you know, and that's the note. But sometimes the note just that gets received is make him move the arm more.
Yeah, because
what does that mean?
Telephone where someone, it's like you tell one person and then by the time it's like, by the time it gets to the artist, it's like, make him turn his head. What? We were talking about legs. This is about frustration. So you're right. It is about clarity of notes and stream of communication.
Yeah. And that applies to everything, you know, like make the presentation shorter, you know, is better than like, you know, then because if you're like, this presentation needs to be out and we need to give it to them, I'm worried these guys have, you know, short attention span, so, you know, we should just tighten it, find a way to tighten it, is a much better note than being like, cut this line and then cut you know, just be like getting into the weeds of like pulling word, don't you know, don't use run-on sentences or something. It's like,
no, but also the other constraint that you have as a director is you're on set, you're shooting, you're working like 16 hours a day. You don't always maybe necessarily have the time to explain the whys of things or like really sit down and go, okay, so for this one shot that's like a second and a half long, this comes from a thing. So it's like, then on top of that, how do you manage and organize your time, which is a whole other, you know, you have this limited resource of time, you know, it's like time, quality and budget. There's three things, but you only ever get two, you know? And so how do you,
every movie wants three, every movie,
but you only get two.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, that's why I said, there's no perfecting it. I mean, I get better at it. You know what I mean? But I am imperfect. I've given a bad note many a time. You know, I'll give a note to VFX and then I'll see the next iteration of the shot and I'll be like, okay, I see what happened here. What I meant was this, and I see that I created a whole web of confusion with the note that I gave. And, you know, it's a craft, man. It's like, you know, it's a discipline. It's like, you know, it's something you never be perfect at, but you try to learn everything you can. You just like,
yeah, but it's also being able to sort of brush your ego out of the way. And then when you get stuff back, that's not what you had in your head, not immediately going, well, this person didn't know what they were doing, but saying like, okay, did I not convey, like, was there something that I could have done to have made this experience better? And how do I improve on that and listening and, you know, but I also can understand why sometimes that can be tough when there's a million things floating around and you have to get a certain number of shots done in that day, because tomorrow you move locations and you're not going to be able to come back. So you like, how do you juggle all of that?
Yeah, no, it's high stress, high stakes situations constantly. And, you know, like it's an interesting experience making a movie because you're just like, you know, if I don't get this scene, I think this changes the higher up you go. You know, if I was making a $200 million movie, this may not be the case. This wouldn't be the case. But I know, even in the budgets that I'm at now, which get bigger in every movie I make, you know, I'm, you know, but I still feel that, I feel that, that pressure of like, if we don't get this scene, it won't be in the movie. Mm-hmm. If this doesn't work now, it won't work. And so, right. It's like, so there is that, that's what adds the stress and the pressure is working against the clock that kills you at the end of the day, that kills your scene, you know? Yeah.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects, but there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What did you learn? So as we're kind of winding this down, what would you say that you, what's your takeaway learning experience? Like what things did you learn from Nightbooks? Like as this is your third movie and they get bigger and bigger budget wise and, you know, more involved, what was your takeaway from this one?
Well, this one was incredibly unique, right? We went and did it at the, I mean, I went June last year, so early COVID.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when I went to Canada, I'm not sure if I was the first, but I was definitely, I think I may have been the first director to go to Canada with Netflix to go make a movie. Maybe the first, I was very early. When I showed up, immigration was like, do you know that there's a global pandemic happening?
I'm aware.
Why are you here? It took me hours to get into the country because they were like, what are you doing here? We really had to figure out what it meant. You know, we couldn't have four people in a room. So what it did, I think, in a way, is reduced everything to its like purest, most simple form. What do I need? What conversations do I need to have before we start shooting? What prep do I need to do? And, you know, I had a mantra with the crew. We get on Zoom and I was like, dude, guys, I want everyone to go home to their family safe. I don't want coronavirus to ever be on our set. I want to protect everyone. And I was like, guys, we need to treat this movie like we're making movies are hard. And we need to treat this like we're shooting a movie on the moon. We are in, you know, an environment that poses great danger to us that could potentially, you know, it is going to require coordination so that we don't stack up, so that we're not in the same space and could get each other sick. I mean, the extensive amount of effort that went into keeping people safe was tremendous. And so I would say that there were a lot of like creative lessons, and those are like sort of longer to explain. But I think my takeaway on this movie, the simplest one to get into, I guess, at the end here, is to just say is really what we were talking about, is how is giving the most information I possibly can to the person who is going to be most responsible for that thing being there. Like if we're talking about sets, I need to be heard by by the person who is overseeing the sets. And I need to communicate in the clearest way. Like this is why I'm not happy yet with this set. This is what I want to achieve, you know, and then this is what I think would get us there. But do you have ideas? And like reshaping the way that you communicate to get better results from people was really the, and doing it in a time when it was over Zoom, even though we were two offices away, so it has to be over Zoom. It was interesting. Or, you know, yeah, doing it through from a phone booth, a plexiglass box that I had to work out of. You know?
Oh my God, that's right. Like, as if directing a film wasn't a steeplechase enough. And it's like, oh, now we're going to add this like global catastrophe on top of it. And all these rules where people's lives literally are, it's like you have to, I mean, it's like, obviously the stakes always feel big, you know, whenever someone's entrusting you with money and reputation or whatever, you know, but it's never life-threatening usually until, you know, 2020. And then it's like, oh, and on top of that, the world is also dangerous. So it's like...
Yeah, and there's kids
on set. The air can kill you, so...
There's kids on set. There's children on set. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's already high stakes. And then you're like, there's children on set. Like, please wear your mask.
Please. You know, keep this as safe as possible for these kids.
Keep it as safe as possible. Like we need, And so, you know, I am proud of everyone involved in this, Netflix, the actors, the crew, everyone. We kept people safe. No one ever got coronavirus on our set. And I like, that was a big accomplishment, you know, for me personally. And I think we made a movie that all of us are really proud of and excited about, because it's so different than family movies than other family movies, you know, and it has a lot of heart and, but you know, I'm just mad, 'cause I know we're wrapping up and I really wanted to talk to you about that thing on Instagram that you posted yesterday. I don't know.
Oh, about the baby.
I am so happy for you, dude.
I can't tell you how glad I am to be able to talk about it. Like you know, 'cause Lydia, we're recording this in late August. And so, but I think this podcast isn't going to come out for about a month, 'cause Nightbooks comes out September 15th on Netflix.
Yes, it does. Watch it.
And so, you know, like, we've known for a few months and we really just told like really just our family and a few people, but you know, we just kind of were getting to the process, making sure everything was okay. And I was totally following Lydia's lead on everything and how she wanted to handle it and, you know, message people, tell people, you know, whatever. And so, but it's just great to be able to talk about it. And it is incredible. Like, it really, that cliche thing that everyone tells you, oh, you just won't, it's because there's literally nothing to compare it to. I don't know. It's just, I think I wrote this on Instagram. You didn't ask all this, but I haven't been able to talk about it a lot.
No, so I want to know.
But that thing that I posted on Instagram where I was like, you know, one of those first ultrasounds where all of a sudden we just see this little gummy bear wiggling around in there. And it's like, oh my God, like it was remarkable. And this complete, it was one of the most incredible and perspective shifting experiences I've ever had, because number one, really just the miracle of nature. Like the thing that it, sure, this is a thing that happens. And for, you know, tens of thousands of years, this is how humans have, you know, propagated and existed or whatever, but it's still so surreal and so like, oh my God. So these two little cells came together and now there's just this thing that's just rapidly forming. And I don't know, in this moment, I really just felt like, oh, nothing else really matters. You know what I mean? Like all these other things, these, you know, and I love to work, careers very, if yes, it's all fun. I love stand up. I love, but all of a sudden everything else just kind of melted away. I'm like, no, this is really the most important thing. And I felt really happy and peaceful about that. Like it felt amazing and it feels amazing. And, you know, that's not to say, you know, we're not going to sleep much for the next several years, but that's fine. Like I don't sleep great anyway.
That's the job, dude. That's the job.
Yeah. But it just like, I don't know. I imagine people who've listened to the podcast regularly sense something was up because I've started asking people kid questions. You know, like, oh, you have kids. So what do you, you know, because I'm just now I'm just trying to absorb information to just be like the coolest, best parent I can be. So, yes, I appreciate that you.
I've never, listen, I don't have a kid, so I don't have that experience, but that, but I have a comparable experience, which is that my entire life, you know, you hear, oh, your wedding day will be like the greatest day of your life. Yeah. And I'm like, how's that possible? How is that possible? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe it will, but I don't know. I've had some great days. I don't know. Like, it'll be a great day, but, and then you like are standing there in the moment and you're like, oh, and it hits you and you're like, is the greatest day of my life. And it's just like the most overwhelming feeling because you're like, I'm surrounded by everyone I love. I'm going to marry the woman I love. Like, you're just like, you can't even speak. And I often hear parents like yourself, like hearing you describe it, it sounds so much like that experience. And it moves me. Like watching you talk about it is so, it's like, it's incredible. Like it's like a life-changing moment for you. And yeah, congrats. I'm so happy.
I appreciate that. And you do, it's like, you know, like you know, we look at people that we know, like David Dasmalchin, and it's like, he'll post about his kids and he just gushes about them and you understand why, but then you realize you're going to have a kid and you're like, oh, I really understand why. They're the most important thing in the world. And they're like, you want them to be happy and safe and feel supported and loved, and you love them. You know, it's like, you really understand this whole other level. And I don't know, like, I know that I'm just the beginning of it. And, but it's remarkable. It really is just, it's fucking remarkable. Like, in the way that we say it's remarkable that a movie gets made, it's remarkable that a person gets made. Like, it's just the processes that occur, you know, where Lydia will go, you know, she's like, I just feel a little tired. It's like, yes, because you're literally forming a person. Your body is forming a person, you know, yes. Like the cellular energy that is involved with what is happening inside you right now is mind blowing. Like the science of it is insane. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and it's like the two of you melted into this like mutant thing that's going to, you know, grow up and have, you know, amazing thoughts and you know, just have like this, a life. This person is going to have a whole life, you know, and it's like, man, it's awesome.
It's really, it's really cool. And it also makes me think that, that maybe that the Martians from Mars Attacks were designed maybe after Tim Burton saw an ultrasound of,
yeah,
because there are these times when you're looking at the ultrasound and the fetus will like turn its head and you see like brain, eyeballs, like the nose cavity and just like this map, like, and you're like, oh my God. And it's hard not to go ack, 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 because it just looks like this little alien, you know, and you see the spine and the bones and the, I mean, it really is just insane. Like watching a person form is very normal and very surreal at the same time, but we're over the moon about it.
Oh man. Congrats. That's, I am over the moon for you. You know, the thing, COVID robs us of all these little moments. And like, you know, if I wish you could have been here in Aspen when we saw your post.
Oh,
you know,
that's, I mean, so nice.
Because it robs you of that moment when everyone's like, oh, you know, like, ah. And it's unfair to you. It's unfair to you guys. You deserve to have that moment, but just know it definitely happened here. All of us were like, ah.
Well, I really appreciate that. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, like, yeah, you know, people have kids every day. They've been having kids for thousands of years, but it does, but it never ceases to be magical when it's happening to you. And so I don't know. Now it's like, we're starting to get to the point where I'm like, okay, now I got to start doing research and I got to make sure, you know, we do all the right. And Lydia's like so on top of stuff. It's amazing. It is amazing. Even the fact that, you know, like she says the term like, we're pregnant. And I'm like, that's very nice of you to give me a co-producer credit. I don't, you know, it's nice that you say it's like the royalist of wees, but I, you know, like you know, you are incubating this life. Thank you for saying, you know, but I really, you know,
I'm an assistant. I'm your assistant.
I'm
your PA. How can I help?
I'm your PA. I'm here, your PA. You know, I can run to the store for you. I can heat up water. Like I could do whatever you need. I really feel like, you know, I feel like the fair thing would be as if like you carried it for a month and then I carried it for a month and then you carried it, you know, it's like, but she's been absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I believe it. That's great. That's great.
Well, it's nice to see your face. And by the way, we love the movie. Liddy and I, we were so excited to get to watch it the other night. And,
Man, I'm glad. I had a suspicion you guys would enjoy it. It felt like, I don't know. It just felt like something, knowing you guys, that you guys would find a connection to. And man, I'm happy to hear that. I really am.
I mean, I knew like when I heard that, you know, what the movie was called and that it was your movie and everything. It's like, oh yeah. I already know. This. It's going to be something fun and weird and gothic and colorful and, you know, like, and it was just all of those things and so much more. So I really hope people watch it. And it is, it's like, it's a movie. It skews more like a traditional fairy tale, like the darkness of like traditional fairy tales. But I do believe that it is still a movie you can watch, you know, with kids, maybe not like 4-year-olds, but like, you know, like kids, like you can watch the movie with your family.
Yes, that's it. We've made it. I made this for families to watch together, to be scared together, but not to push it too far, but to literally push it as far as I possibly can, but just not over that line so that you can't watch it with your family. And that was the goal. And
like Gremlins was a family movie, but it is terrifying in places. Like I wouldn't show Gremlins to like a small child because it's like there are fucking scary gremlins in it that are doing scary gremlin shit. I would still say that it is a family movie, a family Christmas movie, you know?
Yeah. We talked about Large Marge, you know, and how scary Large Marge was when we were making the movie. We talked about like, you know, Roger Rabbit, like the end of Roger Rabbit when it's like, eyes fall out and he's got like cartoon eyes under. He starts talking in a high-pitched voice and he's like,
when I killed your brother, he talked just like, oh my God.
That's so scary. That scared the shit out of me when I was
younger. Oh, and how sad when they melt that sweet little pair of shoes in the dip, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wanted, you know, I wanted it to feel like that. I wanted you to really be scared and really have your heart broken and you know, I didn't want to pull the punches, you know.
Well, excellent job. Congratulations. And
thanks.
You know, I look forward to doing this again after movie number 4, which
me too. I look forward to it.
Do you even have any idea or are you just kind of sitting for a minute?
I'm writing something right now that I think is really cool in between Brightburn and this movie. I wrote something else that I'm also setting up, and I don't know. But the future is unwritten, you know. I always feel like until I'm on set, I don't trust the movies really getting made. So, I'm looking forward to seeing what the future brings. Honestly.
Well, thank you for another wonderful conversation, Dave. It's so good to see you.
It's great to see you.
And now I say the end.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.